Gold recently topped 1300, the highest point in months on news the Fed might hold rates steady for the foreseeable future. Joining us with his outlook on the precious metals and the domestic economy, head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic think tank. Welcome back, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back with us, and I wanted to start off with the price volatility ahead of the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting. Evidently, the Fed Reserve Chair Janet Yellen was to address policies at the meeting, but the Fed Bank of Dallas President Robert Kaplan seemed to have some comments on rates that we'd need to be patient, and that caused a lot of volatility, at least in the precious metals market.
There's a major problem here with what the markets have been looking for and what's been touted in the markets, and what's very specifically, the economy is not in recovery. It's not booming along. It's never fully recovered where it had been back in its pre-2007 recession days. It did recover some, but it never got back to its prior high. And if you look at a number of series ranging from production to housing and such, what you've seen is basically in recent years a period of low-level stagnation. The GDP is just booming along. If you believe those numbers, it's up almost 14% from its pre-recession peak. But the housing sector is generally down 50%. You look at manufacturing, that's down 5 or 6%. You don't count expansion until you've recovered the prior peak's high. So not having recovered the prior peak's high, we've had no expansion in manufacturing now for something like 115 months. Which is the longest in the history of industrial production, which actually goes back 100 years or so to the end of World War I. That's significantly longer, 20-30%, than the two prior periods that at different points had actually been the longest periods of non-expansion. The one that was longest prior to this was the retooling in the manufacturing sector after World War II, and before that it was the first down leg of the Great Depression. We've never seen an economy that like this that has never recovered. Yet at the same time, the Fed has been talking up the economy is booming along, and we're going to raise rates because we've got inflation coming, all sorts of happy things. Well, they in their headline numbers, they haven't had the inflation, and the economy's not booming along. In fact, number of indicators, the better quality indicators, are showing that it's slowing down again. The reason I mention this is that that's beginning to become increasingly obvious in the financial markets. With that type of a background, a number of people are expecting the Fed is not going to raise rates as indicated. They're not going to reduce their balance sheet holdings of treasuries that they bought in the quantitative easing. And in fact, what they may end up doing is re-expanding quantitative easing, where that's devastating for the dollar and very good for gold, is that the reverse of that is what's been propping up the dollar from an underlying fundamental standpoint with the central bank. If the central bank wants to prop its currency, the easiest way to do that is just to raise interest rates. That's what Alan Greenspan did back in 1987 when he became Fed chairman. Dollar was under heavy selling pressure. I think he came in August. He raised rates in September. The market crashed in October. The reason he raised rates was to defend the dollar. What we're seeing here, what we've seen recently in the last couple of years, is a tremendous amount of hype out of the Fed about, oh my goodness, we're going to raise rates, and then we're going to raise rates, and we're going to raise rates. And with all the hype, they've raised rates a couple of times, but most of the time it was just smoke and mirrors. And now where they've been talking about raising rates again, just that's repetitive. Each time they do that, it tends to support the dollar. But if the economy's not recovering, the markets are reading very simply and clearly that the Fed is not going to raise rates. And in fact, if the economy's slowing down, that's a very negative circumstance. Again, the dollar, particularly the Fed, goes back to quantitative easing, which they likely will do, and I'll explain why. The effect there is to, as the dollar sells off, and as the Fed moves back towards quantitative easing, you're going to see significant upside pressure on U.S. inflation. And, of course, that's a very positive element for the picture for gold.
Well, we certainly saw that last week, and we're starting to see signs of it again this week. But, you know, another interesting aspect of the economic story, I mean, obviously we're looking at a disaster in the Houston area. Now, there's the tragedy for the folks there, and then there's the economic ramifications and reverberations that we could feel similar to Hurricane Katrina over a decade later. Do you see something that might prompt our policymakers to take action to support the economy?
It's a tragedy. It's always terrible when you have something like that. You have insurers that are going to take a hit. I'm sure the losses are going to be large there. They plan for this, so presumably the industry would be able to absorb it. Insurance industry, as devastating as it is to the local economy, there are also pluses to the economy there where there's going to be a lot of rebuilding, and it's a mixed picture. Again, it's a terrible tragedy. You have disruption to commerce, of course, people's lives, but there will be some counterbalance there as the area is rebuilt. I don't see it affecting the Fed per se. Near term, it's going to have negative impact, but the economy there will pick up in certain ways from where it hadn't been before. The policy problem with the Fed, with the economy, their primary concern is the banking system, not the economy. All sorts of instabilities in the system when you came effectively to the brink of a systemic collapse in the banking system back in 2008. All the Fed did at that time was do whatever it had to do to prevent a collapse of the banking system. That was in coordination with the Treasury. They just created whatever money, borrowed whatever money, spent whatever money, intervened wherever they had to prevent the system from collapsing. And I can understand that. The problem is that the weakening economy does tend to stress the banking system. So as the economy does weaken here, and at least initially this will have some negative impact, as you pointed out, that does increase stress on the banking system, and again pushes the Fed more towards renewing the quantitative easing, which is effectively debasement of the dollar, monetization of the dollar. I mean, look, my goodness, what happened this last time around where the quantitative easing is still in place. They purchased roughly $5 trillion in securities, and they're still holding them. About half of those are U.S. Treasuries. They haven't liquidated them. The balance sheet adjustment is the liquidation that some people have been looking for. I don't think that's going to happen for a while. I think that's going to end up monetized debt. It's effectively that now when the Treasury pays interest to the Federal Reserve on the $2.5 trillion worth of Treasuries the Fed's holding, the Fed writes a check back to the Treasury for the interest. It's just money they created. That tends to be inflationary. And as they see increased pressure on the banking system, they'll move to monetize more debt and to make sure the banking system stays liquid. Eventually, that becomes very heavily inflationary, and again, that's a dangerous circumstance for the average consumer who's living in a dollar-denominated world, and is a good encouragement for people to seek safety and preservation of purchasing power with a traditional asset such as gold or silver in physical form, where you can hold them. You don't have to worry about whether or not you've locked in your assets in something that's not going to lose its value over time. It'll retain its real value, net of inflation.
You talk about the Fed's balance sheet, and currently at the St. Louis Fed's website, there's been absolutely no liquidation of assets that our policymakers are alluding to and suggesting. Over the past 6 months, there's been a slight uptick.
I'll be putting out a report on that on Friday, in terms of how it's affecting the money supply. But indeed, at least as of the latest reporting of the monetary base by the Federal Reserve, it's been rebounding in the last couple of months. That's picking up. The way they avoided that becoming inflationary, and let me just back off, the monetary base is the Federal Reserve's traditional tool for manipulating the level of the money supply. When they raise the monetary base, they're effectively buying assets from the banks. The banks have cash. The banks lend the money into circulation. It helps the economy. The money gets redeposited, and it increases the money supply. They never allowed the banks to lend the money from the prior quantitative easing into the system. They were looking to save the banks, not the economy. had to save the banks. Had the banks lent that money into the system, you would have seen an increase in the money supply, perhaps a very sharp one, which would have had some positive economic impact and also would have upped the pressure on inflation. But instead, the Fed mandated that the banks redeposit the cash they were getting from the Fed buying up all these treasuries and such. So they deposited with the cash with the Federal Reserve as excess reserves. The Fed paid them interest, paid the banks interest on that. So the banks had income interest from that. But the money that all the money the Fed was pumping in there did not get into common circulation and help the economy. That maybe will change. We'll have to see.
And your thoughts on the Fed funds futures? You know, if we look at the rates there, there looks like there's virtually no odds of a rate hike until at least next summer. And, you know, if sentiment remains where we see it here, static, there might not be any rate hikes next year at all. What are the implications for the domestic economy?
The domestic economy that's to a certain extent driving Fed policy here, and the economy's not recovered. It's turning down again. You look at construction spending, for example, a very volatile series. We've seen year-to-year growth there fall off, and it's now turning down in a manner not seen since the housing collapse back in 2006. And if you look at the housing and construction series, the housing starts, the new and existing home sales, the construction spending, very volatile series, heavily revised over time, but they're all showing a similar pattern now. And you smooth them out for six-month moving average, they're all turning down. We're seeing quarterly contractions. And that's an industry that tends to leads the economy. Again, the housing system collapsed and the housing market collapsed in late 2005 into 2006. The formal economy didn't turn down until the end of 2007. But the indications are there that it's slowing down again. Add to that that you're not getting a standard recovery in manufacturing. Again, the manufacturing sector's been flat and low-level stagnation. Overall industrial production's higher. That's only due to an upturn in oil production. And that's dependent on oil prices not dropping much further. If you have a big sell-off in oil, that'll hurt that sector. So that's a risk for the sector. But separately, part of the problem in oil prices is dollar strength. The Fed has propped the dollar, and the dollar is beginning to sell off. But the dollar is still very high, and the strong dollar was part of an effort, I believe, back in 2014 to introduce some covert financial sanctions against Russia, given the Ukraine circumstance. And what happened there was the oil prices collapsed as the dollar rallied. I think that largely was orchestrated. And that did put some financial stress on the Russians, but it also killed our domestic oil industry. That was part of an exacerbating factor that still is playing out in the economy. So we'll see how that works out. In terms of the fundamental areas that most people look at in terms of productive economic activity, you're not seeing a recovery.
You know, that's intriguing because we did see durable goods fall by the largest amount in 3 years last week, about a 7% drop in July. Of course, they blame that on the aircraft sector, but it goes along, or at least seems to substantiate your thesis, of a weakening underlying economy, or at least macro economy.
There is a legitimate issue in terms of how you measure the aircraft orders, because they jump all over the place. They can be up a couple of 100%. That can be a very significant dollar amount. They go up and down. They dropped 70% last month, but they're up 103% the month before. Back out the aircraft orders, or average them out significantly over. Look at the inflation-adjusted numbers. What you're seeing with new orders for durable goods is the same pattern you're seeing with manufacturing. The series peaked back in 2007. It fell off deeply in recession. There's a little bit of recovery, but it's been in low-level stagnation, never having recovered its pre-recession high. It's moving very much in line with manufacturing. You see this in private indicators that are of good quality, such as the Cass Freight Index. you look at overall trade activity, I'm talking physical volume as opposed to dollar volume. That's the way they measure the economy, is effectively net of price changes. You're seeing the same pattern of same ups and downs. It got a little bit higher coming in towards the end of 2014, and then it turned down again, and we're just flat, never having recovered the 2007 highs in the series.
Just shifting gears here for a moment to the retail sector. We'd heard much early on in the year about the supposed retail apocalypse. You know, there are pockets of strength, and we've seen Amazon, you know, do well. Also, the Spider S&P Retail Index surged a bit in recent weeks, with companies like Abercrombie & Fitch doing well and Williams-Sonoma. Amazon may actually have some competition. Evidently, Google is partnering with Walmart to give free delivery over certain prices in their attempt to break into Amazon's home delivery business.
Personally, I much prefer going to a good quality retail store where I can look at the goods and get a sense as to the quality of it. And if I like it or look at it around, it's much easier than shopping online and hoping that you get something that you like. I don't like the concept myself, but I'm probably too old-fashioned. Well, the retail sales is several-fold. First, the way you get the headline numbers reported, that's in nominal terms. That's before inflation adjustment. The way the economy's measured is usually net of inflation. The reason for that is if your retail sales are up 10% over last year, and you say, wow, my retail sales are up 10%. If inflation's up 10%, though, and your prices are 10% higher, it's only because you raised your prices. It's not because you're getting a higher physical volume. There's a problem with the inflation numbers, headline consumer inflation numbers, which are used in deflating the retail sales, which goes back to the 90s when the government decided that it would recast the way of calculating consumer inflation to reduce the headline inflation rate. The reason they were doing that was very deliberate, and they were very open about it, led by Alan Greenspan of the Fed and endorsed by all involved administrations. If you could reduce the rate of inflation, the headline rate of inflation, the way it was reported, that would reduce cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security, for example, as it would affect people's income and the tax payment arrangements. It would boost people into higher tax brackets, and they'd also get increased revenue there. It was all a gimmick to effectively tax people covertly, and I take strong objection to that. If you're going to raise taxes, raise taxes, but don't try and fool people on what the rate of inflation is. Go through all the niceties of what the government thinks it should do. Keep in mind that the basic concept behind a consumer price index over the decades, actually over the centuries, has been to measure the cost of maintaining a constant standard of living. So that you look at, let's say, the way the series used to be calculated, very simple terms, they'd price out, let's say, a pound of beef, a gallon of gas, a loaf of bread. One year, then they'd measure the same three products the next year, and whatever the difference was in the prices, that would be your rate of inflation, measuring what they refer to as a constant basket of goods. The objection that Greenspan raised was, well, my goodness, if prices go up on steak and steak becomes too expensive, people buy more hamburger. Buy more hamburger, then their cost of living isn't as high. That's not measured in the CPI. No, it wasn't measured in the CPI because the concept was not one of substituting lower quality goods because you couldn't afford to buy the higher quality goods. The question was, how much is inflation going up so that you can make sure your income keeps up with that and you can continue to maintain your lifestyle? But they moved the system over towards a substitution-based CPI. If you're taking something such as retail sales and you're adjusting it for inflation, putting it in what they call constant dollar terms, the way the GDP's reported, if you understate the rate of inflation, you overstate the inflation-adjusted growth. Even inflation-adjusted, you'll find that the headline numbers, given headline CPI inflation, are growing as well. But if you take out the substitution gimmicks that they put into the CPI, you're not seeing the growth there. You're seeing the same pattern that you've got otherwise, low-level stagnation in real terms. not in the nominal terms before inflation adjustment.
Clearly, people are concerned that after, I don't know, a number of years of the greenback having a chance to stage an impressive new uptrend, that's just all fizzled out. I mean, the dollar has plunged to lows not seen in several years. I think you could make the argument that it's broken the uptrend. We'll have to wait and see how things will unfold. A sea change event, and it might bode well for the precious metals, which have stagnated for a few years. Any additional comments on gold and silver?
You probably have seen the peak in the dollar and correspondingly trough in domestic inflation and a trough in the gold and silver prices. Now, those are all markets that can be intervened in at will by the central banks, but if they're going against market pressures, it becomes uneconomical to do so for an extended period of time. Nonetheless, they do occasionally slam gold prices to discourage its ownership, and intervention is usually effective in terms of moving a currency value, but unless you have underlying fundamental support for the currency, that becomes very expensive. Consider, again, back in 1987, what do you do fundamentally to support a currency? Well, what Greenspan did was he raised rates. But that was not too popular with the financial markets. Like, people would sometimes view that as being a negative for the economy. So what was happening is you came into the stock market crash in October of 87. The week before, you had a terrible down day on Friday. It was down something like 150 points. Which in those days was a very big percentage, and I think it was probably the biggest percentage drop, or certainly the largest drop in a long time. Over the weekend, people were nervous about what was going to happen on Monday. Nobody for sure. In Washington, the politicians got together and worked things out. Among other things, our Treasury Secretary then, who was James Baker, came out on Saturday to say that the United States was no longer going to support the dollar against the Deutsche Mark. Well, I'd cut my teeth in the currency market. I mean, Nixon floated the dollar, so that's about the time I came in and got involved in the currencies. I knew that was going to give you dollar selling panic come Monday morning, and that would likely trigger a stock selling panic. When the dollar's weak, that's generally bad news for stocks. Where the market is heavily dependent on foreign capital as it is now. What you've had with the Fed has been artificially propping the dollar here, with all of its rate talk and such. That's drawn in foreign capital into the stock and credit markets. And as the dollar starts to fall here, you're going to see increased selling pressure both in the equities and on the credit market side, which means some upside pressure on interest rates.
Okay, and as we wrap up today, we here at GoldSeek are starting to embrace and see some amazing opportunities and possibilities, and that's the cryptocurrency space. We've gone from roughly a $50 billion market cap on Bitcoin and related cryptocurrencies to $150 plus billion in just a few months' time. And many top VCs, venture capitalists, and some economists are calling for this market to rival the Forex, a $5 trillion market within 5 to 10 years. We actually support that thesis and believe that digital money will not replace any fiat money. It will simply be a competing parallel market, just as the VHS and DVD and then DVR all just paralleled the movie markets and cable TV and whatnot. I guess the real question for you, sir, is whether or not you believe that cryptocurrencies will actually continue to undermine and debase the reserve currency. How do fiat currencies compete in a market where there is a limited supply, no additional currency can be created, there is great demand and incredible usefulness in aspects that traditional fiat money do not have?
Well, it's an interesting question, an interesting market, an interesting phenomenon. It's, as long as you don't have a financial panic and a collapse of the dollar, what you're talking about may come to pass. Problem is, I don't think we're going to get that far. I think what's happening now with the economy is going to kill the prospects of the Fed's stabilizing the system as they'd hoped. The problem is the system collapsed effectively back in the banking panic in 2008. The Fed can't get the economy growing here, which is one reason it's not growing is because of the way they bailed out the banking system. But guess what? If they hadn't bailed out the banking system, you would have had an economic collapse, too. They haven't been able to get things back into a normal course. The system's just never, has just never recovered. And if the Fed has to go back towards its quantitative easing, the currency markets are going to fall apart. At least the dollar is going to fall apart very quickly. And as it does, you're going to see a spike in domestic inflation, which will also create a traditional move to the precious metals. What happens there, I still look for an environment that's going to evolve into a hyperinflation. We have a circumstance right now where the U.S. government, total unfunded liabilities, net present value, plus liabilities that are in place right now. So there's nothing there about the unfunded are generally obligations like Social Security, Medicare. Then you have the debt, which is around $20 trillion. And such. Overall, you're in excess of $100 trillion. There's no way that the federal government can ever cover that, which means eventually they either have to bring the system into balance, which is a painful process, but it's better done sooner rather than later. Or if they can't, it means eventual debasement of the full debasement of the dollar. You see a dollar panic now, it could trigger tremendous flight from the dollar. Big spike in domestic inflation and an exacerbating circumstance that still can evolve into hyperinflation. If you get into a hyperinflation and the type of domestic crisis that it creates in terms of systemic functionality, I don't know that you're going to have your electronic system working. If you own physical gold, you have the precious metal in hand, and frankly, I'd rather hold the precious gold than the equivalent in electronic assets, but that's just because I'm perhaps a little more conservative than some people are.
You can purchase now a physical non-electronic wallet. It's a tiny piece of plastic with gold leaf on it. Plug it into your USB outlet and download onto a non-digital, non-electronic wallet and freeze your digital assets, meaning Bitcoin, Litecoin, any other digital asset, which, of course, now that's the big trend, stocks, bonds, and many, many other balance sheet assets into the digital realm. This revolution might be an interesting addition to the home safe, if you will, or the safe deposit box, because unlike gold and silver, which we are huge proponents of here, it keeps the lights on. We're grateful for that. Digital money can be transferred, and it can, regardless of what people are telling people today, anonymously, using many different methods around the world, of course, in the blink of an eye, peer-to-peer. There's really nothing in the history of economic history so far that offered that ability. It's unique. Here's an example. I mean, just moving diamonds across borders or gold today is a great challenge for many people, and with monetary controls.
I follow you saying there, and it's a very interesting concept, and you know, as long as you're aware of the risks with it and you like the benefits, that's fine. What I'm looking at is battening down the hatches and surviving end-of-the-world type financial scenarios where you may not have access to networks where you can transfer these things or where it might even be recognized. And I'm not saying that's going to happen. But just consider, in terms of physical gold, that not only does it tend to retain its value, but it's also very good for bribing border guards and officials if you're in trouble, you want to get across a border in very difficult times. I mean, I know the people who owe their lives to gold because they're able to bribe away across borders in pre-World War II Europe. I still view that holding the physical metal as being the ultimate safety factor, but what you're describing there has got a lot of benefit as well, as long as you're still able to function. Having both, you've got benefits both. If I had to give up one thing last, it would be physical.
I think it's well said, and I would just add to your thoughts, hold the physical gold and silver. It's the ideal store and crystallization of one's wealth and efforts. You did mention crossing borders. Many of our listeners, you know, they fall into the millionaire camp. Trying to cross a border with $1 million of gold or silver today would be challenging as opposed to, let's say, 1939 or 45 Europe because of the way metal detectors and scanning. In a handheld device for $40, I mean, they can find things that just would have been impossible in the past. And I would note that many hundreds of millions of dollars of Bitcoin can be held on a plastic, non-detectable device, the competing safe haven for people. There's the potential opportunity costs of watching Bitcoin soar from what we think will be around 4,000 to 50 and then onwards, well above 100,000 in the next few years. And there's a lot of support for that I won't go into here. So we want people to start thinking about digital money in tandem with the precious metals. John Williams, just a pleasure. Please tell us more about this website, ShadowStats, all the alternative economic research.
My website is shadowstats.com. I have posted on that, you look in the right-hand side of the homepage, a number of background articles on underlying economic reality. Also have a weekly commentary, which people can subscribe to. It's $175 a year. $89 for 6 months. But if you look at the left-hand column there, it gives you the headlines from the newsletters. It generally gives you an idea as to what we're looking at. We always welcome new subscribers, and we keep updating the site with background information that people find of value. They're most welcome to.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Chris. Thank you for having me.